You're listening to Go with Jamarlin Martin. We have a go hard or go home approach as we talk to the leading tech leaders, politicians, and influencers. Let's go. Today we have the great Kai Bond on Go. Welcome to the show.
Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Kai Bond is a serial entrepreneur. Also, he's an investor for Comcast Ventures. We're going to dive right in. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Sure. So, you know, I've been working in tech for about the last 20 years. Started off at what I thought was the cutting edge in mobile back in the late 90s, you know, traveling back to Botswana, where my mom's from, and seeing, you know, everybody with a phone running around. And I was just like, this is going to be the future. She's from Botswana.
Okay.
And so I was traveling through Africa and saw what was going on in the mobile ecosystem there. And the fact, you know, that in the U.S. at that time, you couldn't even send cross carrier text messages. And people were taking pictures. And, you know, this is a point in time where I saw people doing, you know, mobile commerce in the 90s on the continent. And so I wanted to dive in. So I came back from that trip and was like, I'm going to get into mobile, and started working on messaging, got a job at Microsoft, spent a bunch of years there. And after about 3.5 years at Microsoft, decided that I wanted to get back to New York. So I moved out to Redmond. I came back to New York City, joined a few startups, and quickly realized that most of the people who were running startups that I worked with weren't necessarily that much better at anything than I was, whether that was business development, design, marketing. And so I decided I wanted to take the plunge. They had one skill that I didn't have any expertise in, which is fundraising, which is a whole different ball game. And I was like, all right, I got to master that. So, you know, founded a company in 2005, 2006. There was a marketplace for trading video games. We were trying to be the StubHub for the gaming industry at a time where people were still getting Netflix, you know, DVDs in the mail. We had a peer-to-peer trading platform for used games. That business wound down after about 2 years, a lot of struggles, a lot of hardship, you know, dead broke, tons of debt, and pouring everything that I had into
payroll.
payroll, not paying myself so I could pay everybody else.
Yeah.
And, you know, after, you know, putting myself in that kind of, you know, debt and hardship, there was only one thing to do, and it was go back and do it again. So I started another company a couple years later in the cash gaming space. This was 2010. We fundamentally believe that PASPA, which is the regulatory environment around gambling, was going to change in 2012, was kind of our prediction. So we started a company called Cash Play Games. Those were chance-based casino games, like slots, dice, and roulette, tied to a sweepstakes engine. So we ran that company for a while, another crazy journey as an entrepreneur, you know, got to a signed LOI to acquire the company for about $20 million. 1 hour before the LOI expired, term sheet was pulled. They ended up acquiring a competitor. They were running a process. Superstorm Sandy hit.
How much money was put in?
$600,000. Yeah. So it was a good outcome right at that point in time. And it was only 9 months in. And so, you know, that term sheet got pulled. Like, a lot of lessons there again, just pain.
Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
I have experience with that where, you know, there's a deal on the table or someone's talking, you know, some really big talk. You may even start due diligence.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the mistakes with entrepreneurs counting the money?
Yeah.
Before the money's in the bank, essentially, you know, folks expecting some type of value to come into the company. They may start hiring, they may start looking at all these different things, but talk about that.
Deal's not done until the deal is done. Like, you know, we took our entire senior leadership team of this company out to Seattle. My CTO, the head of the game studio, myself, two engineers. You know, we had Visa transfer agreements done. You know, this deal was, I looked over at the banker and I was like, what's good? And he was like, this is a layup. And he's like, let's go and drink. And I'm like, nah, we're not drinking tonight. We're not celebrating, you know. Term sheet doesn't expire until Friday at midnight. Like, I'm taking a red eye home. I'm staying here, you know. And I think the expectation, the excitement, people get carried away either with the money or the success, you know. And so, you know, we were still running the business as if nothing changed. You know, we knew that we had to execute and deliver. So when we got back, you know, the best thing that happened was my CTO was in the room. And when I talked about what happened, and he had his laptop open, you know, sad faces in the room. People were going to make $1 million.
I imagine.
He just shut his laptop and was like, fuck them. I didn't want to be acquired by them anyway. I got work to do, and just went back to his desk. Wow. He was like, I don't even want to hear anymore. Like, yeah. I don't care about the explanation or the reasoning or the logic or whatever. Like, we still have a good business. Let's get back into it, yeah. You know. But I think a lot of people have conversations. You know, I've seen entrepreneurs get carried away, you know, even if deals don't go that far in diligence. You know, it's just like anything else. On the venture side, term sheets get pulled, yeah. You know, in the long diligence process. And M&A term sheets get pulled in deep transactions for commercial partnerships late on in the game. And what you need to realize is no matter what somebody is telling you, you know, they may be a champion in the organization. You know, the person that we were working with was a senior vice president, but the CEO had two competing teams looking at deals in the same space to satisfy the same slot that they wanted filled. And he got these proposals back to him and he chose one of the two, you know? So the person who was the champion for our deal left a month later, you know, he didn't get the deal he wanted done. And so, you know, and these guys both reported to the CEO of the business. And so you got to get right to the top, you know, and until it's done, it's not.
That deal doesn't happen at Switch Games. What happens next?
Yeah. So, you know, it was a tough time. Superstorm Sandy hit. You know, we couldn't raise money, you know, at that point. It was late. It was late in the Q4, which is a terrible time to fundraise, right? You're into November now. You know, nobody's going to take a new deal and try to get it rushed through to committee, you know, before Christmas. So we try to bootstrap and keep the business alive and keep it going. You know, we had O-1 visas. We had H-1 visas. So we couldn't bootstrap because they can't go down to zero salary.
Yeah.
Based on sort of the structure of the language in these visa agreements. So we had to shut the business down. And, you know, that was devastating, right? That was one of the hardest times in my life. And, you know, I took some time off to try and reflect, you know, and I told a story the other day. You know, I sat down in an office, you know, I was getting older and I was like, man, I got responsibilities, you know, I got to figure out what I'm going to do.
You're in a deep depression.
Yeah, there. It's just you're in a funk, man. Yeah. You're in the haze, you know, like you go from what you think is the top of the world, you know, owning, you know, 50% of a business, there's going to be a real outcome to winding down a company in less than 120 days.
Yeah.
And so the psychological pressure, the emotional pressure, you know, I got sick. I was physically ill, you know, for a while and you know, really contemplated what I was going to do. I sat down at an office and I took a job. I took a normal job again, which I hadn't done for like 10 years. And I looked around and I was like, I made a mistake. I had to go to the guy who hired me and walk down the hall and was like, this isn't going to happen. I can't stay here. This isn't for me. He's like, what happened? I didn't even make it to orientation.
Yeah.
Like, you know?
Yeah. Like, and man, so, this guy's like, I can see them saying, like, man, this guy's unstable.
Yeah, exactly. It's crazy. And I am. So, because I went back and did another startup.
Yeah.
And I did a third startup. And this time it was in the smart TV space. It was in, you know, the platform side. And we had a very simple vision, which was all broadcast television is the same. And when you sit in front of the television and you have another screen, you're getting your custom personalized content directly from that phone or tablet or laptop. And, you know, our main vision was how do we take the content on a mobile device and put it directly on TV, you know, custom Twitter feed, Instagram, whatever it may be. We ended up signing a partnership with CBS where we did fantasy football real time, you know, your scores, your opponent's scores, stats, league standings across the board as a custom ticker. And as we rolled that out, we knew that the interactive media teams were loving it. We were taking it to people, we were showing it to them. It was a you know, WYSIWYG editor to get all of their second screen content directly on TV, you know, sort of fulfilling this vision around custom content delivery. And what we realized over time was that there was actually a larger problem. There was a larger set of challenges that they had. And that was actually the fragmentation in the ecosystem that we saw early on. In mobile was very similar, right? You've got Samsung, LG, Roku, Xbox, you know, Apple, PlayStation, you know, Chromecast. You go through the list, they have to support, you know, 10 platforms. And so we ended up taking our software and creating a WYSIWYG editor that allowed for rapid development of smart TV apps. And that was, you know, kind of something that we could sell. It was a SaaS platform. It wasn't just a media play. And when we would go in and talk to the people that were spending $250,000 to $500,000 per smart TV app and telling them that for a tenth of the price, we could support 90% of the functionality, they bought it. And so we started selling this to large media companies. And once we started getting traction on both fronts, we had a meeting with a team in at Samsung in Suwon in South Korea. And we flew out and we met the leadership team there, a gentleman by the name of BK Yoon, who ran their TV team, who's the CEO of the TV side for a long time, I think a lifetime Samsung executive. And he stopped me about halfway through the meeting when we were talking about our platform and was like, stop. He was like, we'd like to buy the company. So we ended up, you know, having that transaction, you know, in the meeting real time. Wow. And after about 9 months of building, we ended up selling the business after about 13 months.
How does that happen in a meeting where, you know, you start talking about deal terms?
Yeah, we, you know, that was a unique case. They were building something that was very similar. They had the same vision and alignment. And so when we started talking, you know, even though my Korean is non-existent and their English wasn't great, we were speaking the same language because we knew the value that we wanted to deliver to customers on TV. They were already working on an integration for custom content. It was a brother by the name of Ty Ahmad Taylor, a guy, Jim Albrecht, out in California in San Jose. And so when we had the right sort of core technical DNA and proven traction, and they had the hardware and distribution. Those two things came together, and you know, it was a no-brainer at that point in time.
When you're talking about valuation and maybe an earnout, that's in that discussion?
It wasn't. There was a conversation that was, you know, we want to buy, and you know, we were there, you know, being represented by some of the folks in the U.S. and you know, they kind of were like, look, we'll take this discussion offline. Yeah. You know, yeah. but we want to
hook up, but we'll talk about
it.
It was clear intent.
Like, hey, we don't want to just partner here, right? Yeah. Like, we see something more strategic. We were open to it. We knew how difficult the market was after having, you know, spent our time, you know, looking at the space and doing a market analysis of the TAM. And the conversations took about 3 months to close the transaction, though, because that was April.
Yeah.
And that was a wild time because, you know, it was the World Cup. We were doing our largest launch ever around the World Cup and having this interactive content globally. And that's really what kind of got everything going in that June timeframe to really push towards an August transaction.
So you're not going to shop that deal with the buyer.
You know, we had strategic investment from Samsung on the venture side, and they had been great partners to us. You know, we went 3 months into the company. David Un, who's now the chief innovation officer at Samsung Next here in the U.S., you know, he gave us a platform, right? People talk about corporates and strategics, but, you know, BK Yoon came to the U.S. for our office opening. And we were 60 days in, and David was like, you're going to give a demo, you know? And I'm like, we're not ready to give a demo. What are you, crazy? And he's like, you're going to give a demo, you know? Yeah. And we did, you know, we worked around the clock to get this thing polished in a way that we could show something off. And the app crashed. We tried to launch it. Yeah. Oh, we were trying to give this demo. We've been testing it all day at work. Of course, we fired up the TV and it crashed. And people were like, what the hell is this? But nonetheless, that senior level, like C-level exposure at day 60, then when we went back 180 and showed them what we were doing, I mean, it was crazy, you know? And so that was part of the nature of our relationship, the alignment, and what we felt was right for the business in that time.
Was there any argument internally like, hey, you still need to shop this deal?
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
You need to go through some price discovery.
Yeah, we probably should have, right? And we had that opportunity. For us, the unique nature of the alignment and where we were going post-acquisition was a huge difference. Ty was running the division. He was a brother who I knew for a long time. And I worked in M&A, right, at IAC. And we acquired a bunch of businesses in the game space when I was there. And, you know, seeing post-merger integration go wrong and people not hitting earnouts and leaving, you know, we were in a unique space where they were acquiring Boxy, you know, the guys who had created the smart TV hardware box. They were moving into an office on 18th Street. We didn't have to relocate. Like, you know, our lives weren't going to be up, you know, upended and have to move. And so there were a lot of things that were aligned outside of price that we knew that would dictate the success and happiness of the business and me as a person, and going through two failed startups and knowing that, you know,
things can happen.
Cost isn't, you know, price isn't everything for me at that point in time. Like, money's great, but it's not going to buy you happiness. And so that part of the equation was key for us.
Got it. And so how do you get to Comcast after this deal?
Yeah. So I spent a year, you know, sort of integrating our software and our stack and our team into this larger division and org. We launched it. It's now called Samsung Extra. You know, it was launched at CES. There was a big event around it. It was great. After a year, I'm a terrible, terrible employee. You know, I've been managing my own business for 10 years. I was now in a 180,000 person division in a 300,000 person company. And I was traveling back and forth to Seoul once a month. I was on the West Coast once a month. You know, it was just physically taxing. And I had the conversation that I wanted to leave, and they were fortunate enough to say, why don't you come and to Samsung Next, which is our software innovation fund in the US, and run our accelerator in New York. And I was like, word, like, early stage, that's where I'm at. I love New York. I know how to navigate Samsung for strategic. And this was right around VR when they were rolling out the headsets, where there was a lot of AI and smart home technology and just different segments of the market that I was interested in, right? I'd always worked in mobile and gaming and media and entertainment. And so I wanted to get more into some of the deep tech side of the house. And so I spent a year running that program. And I got an opportunity to meet the Comcast Ventures folks. And I'd known them for years in the New York ecosystem and pitched them several times and always had a good experience working with them. And, you know, they reached out to
me. They turned you down before.
They turned me down three times, you know. But I went to work there regardless, because the way in which they were thoughtful and engaged in the feedback, I actually went and read all the emails from when they turned my business down.
Were you pitching to Crowder?
No. So at the time, I was pitching to Sam Landman and Andrew Cleland in New York. Andrew was on the board of FanDuel. And, I was doing a cash gaming business, you're right. So he kind of knew what was going on. Sam had done a bunch of the interactive media stuff and streaming. He's an investor in Cheddar TV and kind of understands the new form of media that's coming out. So, you know, when I was pitching, my most recent business in Pixie TV, I talked to him. And I went and read all the emails and how they turned me down and why and what they thought was going to go wrong and the issues. And they were right, and some of the challenges in market size, right? Some of those deals, it was a good outcome for me because we only raised a couple $100,000. It's not an outcome that's going to be a fund maker for one of them, right? And so had some conversations. They had this opportunity to join in New York, which was really a unique role. It was a two-sided role. One of it was, you know, running Catalyst Fund, right? So that's really what I came into Comcast Ventures for, is to manage Catalyst Fund. That's a $20 million fund focused on African-American and Latino founders, right? We all know the stats. Less than 1% of venture capital goes there. $130 billion of venture capital in the ecosystem last year. You know, only 26, you know, female founders of color, you know, have raised more than $1 million, right? The disparity's crazy. And so I knew how hard it was for me over the course of, you know, 10 years raising money as a founder. And I figured that, you know, what better position could I be in than to coach and mentor and advise on the things that I've done well and done poorly, distribute capital to phenomenal founders, and sort of try to help manage those to successful outcomes, right? And so I had the opportunity to join. I jumped at it. An investor who invested in my business, and I worked at Hatch Labs during sort of the investment in Tinder and ran cash play out of that accelerator. You know, Dinesh Morjani, he's the managing director out in LA, and he joined a couple months prior to me. And knowing that the guys in New York were good, Dinesh was on my voting committee, sort of everything came together, and we were able to kind of take it to the next level. So I've been there now for about 2.5 years.
Do you have the autonomy where I want this deal and, hey, I can't get vetoed?
Yeah. So, you know, every fund is different, and there's check writing and discretion at various levels. You know, I have an investment committee on the Catalyst Fund side. You know, it's a 3-person committee, majority rules. I don't have 100% discretion of I can just go and cut a check. But the investment committee is supportive because I've developed you know, specific themes and philosophies around sections of the market in direct-to-consumer, in gaming, in marketplaces that are well-defined. And so if something falls within that wheelhouse and we have capital to deploy, we're going to go after it aggressively. And the likelihood that that deal gets done is damn near 99%, unless there's something really hairy about the deal or an issue.
99%, yeah. If you're bullish on something, yeah, you're pretty much, it's a go.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And at the end of the day, you know, the committee is there to provide support, feedback, right? These are smart people who have been working in venture for a long time. And having that, you know, lens and that feedback is important to get to the right outcomes.
What's your average check size?
Last year it was about 450. We say about 500,000, but we did a couple of smaller checks as well fit in. You know, we target 500K at the seed as a sweet spot for us. You know, if we can invest and try to push, you know, towards, you know, 10% ownership at that phase, that's great. But if there are outsized returns with larger rounds and specific founders or an opportunity to get into a space where we can add a tremendous amount of value, a market that we know, we'll make exceptions for sure. And so checks can go up or down. You know, we did a $3 million check into an AI company up in Toronto that's disrupting the legal space. And so, you know, that came partially out of Comcast Ventures and partially out of Catalyst Fund, right? And yeah. So we have this ability to work together. The way that we try to structure everything now is we have autonomy, you know, at the seed to really do what I want. But if I'm trying to, you know, really push in Series A and be supportive of a business, you know, that's what we did with Ross Intelligence, right? We did the seed out of Catalyst, and then we wrote an even larger check at the A with the support of Comcast Ventures so we could come in and buy real ownership up, you know. And these are businesses that we all believe in, you know.
Yeah.
The lens that I want to go through is I don't care if it's a black or a brown founder. The deal should be good enough that, you know, everybody in the main fund wants in on this, right?
Yeah.
And you know, you see that with a multitude of tier one VCs who've invested alongside us with Catalyst.
What has been your toughest no, where hey, you went home and maybe thought about that a couple of nights, like that was a tough one? Or have you had a tough one?
I have
that? Yeah.
I can't name the specific deal. It was a larger deal. It was a $250 million check that I wanted to push through this year.
$250?
Yeah, and so wow. We had to go, you know, it was even beyond the scope of ventures and take it up a level to corporate. It was a huge check. It was a tough time to get it done. Obviously, you know, we had gone through a large transaction with Sky TV and, you know, we have some of this capability, you know, when you look at some of the investments we've made with, you know, even NBC and Comcast, you know, as an example, you know, something like Snap, right, where we come in pre-IPO with a $500 million check, right?
Yeah.
And these are the types of deals that are, you know, going public that'll be real market movers. And so it was exciting to work
like
on
because I focus
on the seed most of the time. And so it was exciting to work on something larger and later stage. And it was very difficult to hear the no because, you know, a seed deal you might work on for 2 or 4 weeks, you know, you're going to get to a no, you're going to wire out pretty quickly.
Yeah.
You know, when you take a full quarter to do diligence on one deal and you shut everything else down to kind of move forward with it, it's frustrating. And when you think it's the right thing for the business, it's frustrating. But at the end of the day, you know, I understand why, you know, and the logic behind it. And, you know, I think there's no venture capitalist that you will talk to who will either say, I regretted passing on a deal or I regretted a deal that I couldn't get pushed through committee in some way. And so I don't think it's unique to me in any way, but you know, I felt my lumps on that one for sure.
There were reports that, I don't know if it was your fund or Comcast Ventures was looking at Fyre Festival.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Fyre Festival has been in the news.
Yeah.
There were flags raised in the due diligence process. Can you yep. talk about
sure.
anything about that?
Yeah. Sure. I mean, look, we see thousands of deals a year, right?
Yeah.
The reality is I see about 400 to 600 deals on an annual basis, depending on the year and repeat founders and how you count new. You know, you talk about a partnership of 8 and principals, you know, across the board, we're looking at thousands of deals. And there's a reason why you do diligence the way that you do
yeah.
and dig into company financials and understand the flow of capital and what's going on. We did our diligence and we passed, right? And
yeah.
I think there's a lot that's, you know, misrepresented in the media about, you know, what the ins and outs of that were. I can't speak at length to it, but what I will say is, you know, we passed. And I think at the end of the day, you know, what gets caught up is that, you know, oh, we were looking at this, like the ticketing business, we looked at one section of it, we had an exploration into the other, we passed. And that was that.
How does that, someone's pitching a festival to you. I mean, before you get to the due diligence, how are you looking at it in terms of its tech orientation? Or was there something kind of more tech that people don't know about?
I mean, I don't know if you've seen the documentaries, but, you know, there was a business there, you know, that was really a lead gen business, right, around booking and a marketplace business. And that was what was most interesting to us, right? We look at marketplace businesses. You know, we haven't done events businesses or festival businesses. That's what gave us the most pause anyway, right? And, like, why would you get into this if you have this other core business that's great over here? What, you know? So, you know, it is what it is. Like I said, I can't talk at length about it, given sort of the communications plan on our team. But, you know, that's all I'll say on it.
Before an entrepreneur steps to you with a pitch and they're fortunate enough to get an introduction or talk to you, based on your experience, what do they need to know absolutely before they think about stepping to you?
Yeah, I always say, you know, it's easy to do research, right? Like, everybody has a Twitter feed or a LinkedIn profile or a blog. Like, people come to me all the time and they're like, so what do you guys do here? You know, and I'm like, it's so easy to come out and know. Yeah, they're like, so what are you investing in? You know, well, it's all public, right? Yeah. It's all out there. You can look at our website. Like, immediately, you haven't done your homework on this? Yeah. Like, you know, that's just sloppy, right? There's no excuse for that. You can do that walking from Broadway Lafayette stop to our office, you know, 250 feet, you could pull up our website and see what we've invested in, you know, the last five deals we've done. So, you know, that's a red flag for us, you know, not knowing the fund and our focus and what we've invested in, not knowing my background and, you know, listening to the podcast that I'm in. You know, if you're really serious and you want to, you know, build a relationship with somebody, you know, I'm doing the same stalking online before everybody else comes in.
Yeah.
Who do we know? Who are we mutually connected to?
So I would call this the lack of seriousness flag, where, you know, entrepreneurs are pitching to 100, 200 people and people coming to you and they don't understand the severity of this meeting in terms of that may be one out of 100 that says yes, but they won't do the research.
It's simple and it's sloppy, and I see it happen too much, that people just don't do their homework on us as a fund or don't do their background checks on the people they're talking to. It goes a long way. You know, I think the other side is, you know, when there are, you know, it's clear that a founder doesn't have a really good understanding of the unit economics. You know, the deals that I've done and the investments I've made, you know, you can look at it and it's like, we know our CAC to LTV, we know our conversion rates, our funnel, our pricing, where there are levers, what we can change in our, you know, distribution system, you know, as we scale to, you know, gain more profitability. And, you know, most of the time I'm investing at the seed. Right. And so I, you know, and this is the entire goal of a seed process, right? It's like, understand your unit economics, right? When you get to the A, it's just pouring fuel on the fire. And so, you know, when someone comes to me and they're like, well, you know, I'd have to go back and get that stat. When I was a founder, I was living and breathing those numbers every day. You know, that was breakfast, lunch, dinner, midnight snack, looking at and running a custom profile of analytics and trying to figure that out. And to me, if somebody doesn't understand that as a founder, I feel so distant, right, from them, because that just seems so core to the mission. And so unit economics and understanding their business just inside and out, to me, instead of just selling the vision, right? But I do think there are a lot of people who get who focus too much on this, you know, myopic nature and forget to think about the big picture and sell the vision, right? And tell the story and the narrative. And I think that is an important component, because you're going to be telling a story to your venture investors, a story to your employees, you know, if you go public to Wall Street, right? And so you have to have this balance of the creativity, the storytelling, as well as the fundamentals, right? And those to me are the people who, you know, make up the best profile for CEOs.
How often do you get in a situation where the founder comes in and they're so nervous, it makes the meeting difficult? They're tripping up over stuff. They're fumbling. You know, they're uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know, this is a big meeting for them. How often does that happen?
Not as much as you'd think. Yeah. I think hopefully, you know, people don't feel, you know, threatened or whatever. We try to, you know, I try to create an environment and tell a story of my failures and be very transparent that I've been through the hard times just like any other founder. And so the founder struggle should be something that's natural and okay, because we all go through it. But I tend to find that most people are confident, or if not, they can at least mask it for that hour they're sitting across from me.
So it's very rare for you to get somebody fumbling.
Yeah, I'm not important enough.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off, or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs, and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
What market segments do you have a unique thesis on in your fund, where you're really looking at, hey, you know, this is a underserved, or, you know, a segment that's really interesting?
Yeah. So we've done a bunch of direct to consumer investments. You know, one of them is Lust Brands. They're based up in Toronto. It's a hair care product for African-American women that focuses on curly, wavy, and kinky hair. It's shampoo, conditioner, and all-in-one. You know, it's a product my wife uses, you know, you know, I had a conversation with the founder, and I was like, there's nobody out there who's creating a brand presence, you know, here in this space around hair care for this segment and curly haired women. And so, you know, I think the way that I look at it is there an underserved, you know, market that isn't, the needs aren't being met, and there's an authentic voice and, you know, product being created by the CEO. You know, WeShave is one that we recently did with Karen in New York, focused on, you know, female care. I think she's a phenomenal CEO. So certainly direct to consumer is one of those that we formed a hypothesis around, you know, the care space. Gaming is another one. You know, our thesis in gaming is really around three things. You know, core IP. We look for people who are creating original IP that's unique, that goes across platform, focused on multiplayer. We did an investment in a game studio called Kite and Lightning that's based out in LA, that's making a battle royale game that's a fighter. So, you know, my generation, we had Tekken and Street Fighter, Mortal Kombat, you know. But this studio is creating what I believe is the Fortnite version of a fighting game, right? Free to play, monetized through in-app purchases, cross-platform. And I think that there's a huge market potential there, right? And that they're creating it. Then we have that social layer around community that we think gaming, if you saw what happened, you know, last week in Fortnite, one of the largest concerts in the world happened. 60 million people are sitting there flying, hovering in, being spawned, you know, participating in a music concert, not even playing Fortnite, but on the platform. And so we do think that there's going to be a lot of social and community elements in and around gaming. We invested in Players Lounge, which is head-to-head wagering on games of skill. So if you and I wanted to go and play a game of Madden right now, I could pick my team, you pick yours, wager $10 each, platform gets a 10% cut, you know, the winner takes the rest. So that's the second component. And then the third component is really around tech and tools and infrastructure and gaming. I've been spending a lot of time in the cloud gaming space most recently. I think we're going to see the same things that we saw in the film business and the movie business, going from physical purchases, going to the cloud. You're already starting to see that, but there's more and more opportunity there. So, you know, for every single market that we go in, direct to consumer, whether it's gaming, you know, we develop our philosophies around those verticals and try to find the best founders. And, you know, all of the founders that I've mentioned there, African-American, Latino founders, you know, doing something really unique in their market, in their vertical.
Back to Street Fighter 2.
Street Fighter 2. I was a Tekken guy. I don't know, you know, so.
Did you guys look at Bevel? You mentioned, you know, you invested in a hair products company.
Yeah.
Did you look at that deal at any point?
I think that they looked at it prior to my time coming into the fund. You know, obviously, given, you know, Dollar Shave Club, we had a lot of familiarity with the market. I think that we always look at as a portfolio construction, you know, density and where we're putting our dollars to work. And, you know, we had a good amount of money allocated into a business already. And obviously, Dollar Shave was a phenomenal outcome. I think it was a $1.6 billion exit. So it was a great return for the fund. But, you know, I don't have much exposure into that one.
Do you guys have any initiatives where, okay, I'm looking for all these things in terms of unit economics, you need this understanding, you know, this is not a charity, but there's a cultural deficiency in terms of the legacy of white supremacy and racism in the United States, yeah. where Black America is a bit behind in terms of other communities. So to get the community up to the level where they have a higher probability of getting a check from you,
yeah.
Do you guys do anything kind of internally yeah. to provide kind of knowledge stimulus in the community?
Yep. So I sort of think of this one as hand-to-hand combat when I talk about it, right? As opposed to bringing in the army, you know, we kind of send in the special forces. And so, you know, we do things, as an example, with Gunderson Dettmer, you know, office hours around legal, you know, and what to look for in term sheets, right? And what are the gotchas and side letters and expectations at the seed versus the A? And, you know, how does the cap tables work? And so we'll run workshops where we go and set up and identify office hours, whether it's at Black Tech Week or Afro Tech or, you know, just in New York, right, on a Friday afternoon where we bring people in. So we'll do this around cloud services where we have partnerships with all of the major players in the space where we'll offer up special credits, you know, and really what it comes down to. And the reason why I got into venture investing was really to help founders, right? That was my goal, was, you know, deploying capital is great and cutting checks. But I know that out of the 500 meetings I'm going to take in a year, I'm going to invest in 5 or 6 founders.
You're taking the other 500 meetings a year?
Yeah. The other 495 or 493 that I take, that's just about building, right? It's trying to have an honest dialogue. How can I be helpful? Do you want feedback on your deck? You know, what does it look like? So, you know, we have some things that we've done at sort of an institutional level where we have office hours and workshops and work with partners. A lot of it just comes down to spending time with founders. I feel like that's where you get the most value, is those one-on-ones. We do founder dinners. We do venture networking events. It's busy. We're always just grinding, trying to help.
You probably read about over the last month or so, there's been about 2,000 layoffs in the media industry. So, you know, BuzzFeed, McClatchy, there's a depression, right? A lot of deflation in the media industry. When you think about the duopoly of Google and Facebook taking up to 80% of mobile ad dollars, you know, they have the market on lock in terms of their scale, their political lobbying, lack of regulation. Do you feel like they should be held accountable for the bear market in media, where it's harder and harder for people to get quality media? And for, you know, we saw Cambridge Analytica, that issue, the political issue with Facebook, but it's getting harder and harder to provide quality information that's ad supported. And so, you know, politically, how do you think that should be addressed? Particularly with Facebook and Google.
It's an interesting time to be in media, right? This is a disruption that started 15 years ago, and you saw print subscriptions dropping and online lagging and now not being able to keep pace. You know, from a fund perspective, you know, we've done, you know, investments in things like The Athletic, right, which is subscription-based content. And I do believe that most people are willing to pay for quality product. I believe in that. You look at, you know, New York Times, right? They had, I think they just announced $800 million quarter in digital this year. You look at, there's a great founder who started a company called Nickel. And what they're doing is taking different types of bundling content. So let's imagine you don't want to subscribe to the New York Times for an entire year, but you think that their political coverage leading up to the elections are great.
Yeah.
You can just take that part of the content, bundle it up, use their SDK, and have that coverage go on for a 30-day window leading up to the primaries, right? So I tend to think less about the regulatory environment in my shoes. I'm sure that other people spend more time there. The place where I spend most of my time is thinking through what are either tech and platform solutions or lasting media businesses where people are willing to spend time and money. And I believe those investment opportunities are out there. And we are going to see a rise of what we're seeing happen in streaming video, right? Yeah. And now with taking content and creating something that's compelling that people are willing to pay for.
Yeah, let's try to take you out of the Comcast Ventures VC seat and say, hey, look, if Google and Facebook are going to take all the advertising money or most of the ad money, and where other entrepreneurs or media companies are going to have to all go subscription because they're going to take all the ad money. Structurally, you know, there seems to be issues because there's just so much a kind of app space on someone's phone, or there's going to be limitations of everybody rolling out subscriptions, of course. And so what does that mean for the degradation of people getting information efficiently, where I believe that that could become a systemic risk to democracy or, you know, certain things that we've become used to.
Right. I was just actually over at the Knight Foundation talking to their team about this exact issue. And they do a lot of work around this particular topic of honest, you know, statistically relevant, factual news, right, and reporting and trying to start initiatives where funding local news, right, that will allow you to get this type of access. You know, I think there's probably two areas to unbundle there, right? One of them is, you know, what is going on in the advertising space, right? Where's the flow of dollars, right? And how does that revenue distribution go back to independent publishers who might not be able to roll out large scale subscription offerings, right, and generate a profit in that way? I don't know what the right answer is, right, from a regulatory environment, right? I feel like oftentimes big tech is an easy out, right, for people to say, oh, I'm going to blame these companies for all of the problems that are happening in advertising, right? Well, you talk to a lot of people out there, they're still buying users and buying traffic from those entities, and it's the most effective way beyond TV and radio. So you have the same people complaining about lack of monetization on a platform, and at the same time, they're buying users, right? So,
well, everybody's
there's a little bit of that, right, going on.
Yeah, but everybody's locked in. I mean, once the duopoly or monopoly has been executed and the users are locked in, you know, I call into question conventional views of choice,
right?
Where if everybody is concentrated on these platforms, the amount of choice people, our businesses have, are limited. So I'm gonna give you a couple of reports and facts. So,
all right.
So one, it's been reported that Senator out of New York, Charles Schumer, his daughter works at Facebook. Also, it's been reported by the New York Times that Mark Warner wanted to investigate Facebook, and Charles Schumer told Mark Warner to back off. Charles Schumer, he has relationships, it looks like, with Sheryl Sandberg. Nancy Pelosi, her family, they own millions of dollars of Facebook stock, and they've been buying the dip. Of course, Facebook's share price has dropped, and they've still been buying. All the scandals, but the Pelosi family, mostly, I guess you could say her husband, is buying Facebook stock. Because under the Obama administration, there was a lack of regulation. There wasn't, you know, we didn't hear about any kind of consumer privacy report. There wasn't any real legislation to police big tech in Silicon Valley, like a lot of black and brown people are policed in the streets, meaning that the corporate behavior, I believe, was not regulated. Do you have any feelings about the coziness of mainly corporate Democrats in Silicon Valley where, hey, you know, we're backing a lot of the Democrat politicians. They're friends. They have elite networks. In Cory Booker's case, a lot of the elites invested in a company that was sold. Some people, you know, are skeptical. But do you believe there should be fundamental distance between our politicians and corporate interests that are looking to lobby and impair regulations where their interests come before the public?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, when you look at it, that problem's not unique to tech, right? That revolving door of people coming in and going out to industry, right, and lobbying on behalf and then getting a cozy job, you know, post, you know, term, right, and serving as a politician. That's been going on for years, right? And I think the revolving door problems that we have are terrible. So
like, would you be skeptical, like, hey, Eric Holder, Justice Department, DOJ, there's not a lot of talk about Silicon Valley. Of course, the Obama and Eric Holder in the bed with Silicon Valley, but he goes and starts getting checks as soon as he leaves out of Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley companies are now paying him to do work.
Yeah.
Do you have an issue with
that? Yeah, I mean, look, like I said, this has been going on for years. It's I don't think it's unique to the Obama administration. Like, I think it goes back, it predates that, right?
Yeah.
It's a problem. And, you know, I think there's a couple of solutions. One of them, I actually think, pay politicians more, right? Like, make it a compelling job that kids want to go into, right? Right now, if you talk to, you know, people who are like, oh, I want to go in and be a politician, right? Like, how many kids are coming out of high school saying that? They want to go into industry. They want to go in. Like, pay the right amount of money to attract the talent so that people don't have to rely on lobbyists when they get out of office, right? I actually think that there's an argument to be made.
A lot of these people, like Nancy Pelosi, you're talking about multimillionaires.
Yeah.
A lot of these politicians, Eric Holder, I don't think it's the question of, hey, can they make a sufficient income? It's, hey, I can make 5 or 10 million by consulting for Goldman Sachs or doing this stuff or going to UBS or whatever, that it's greed. Hey, I got it. I make a living and I'm going to go grab the biggest check. But I think there needs to be a movement to break up this coziness with corporate interests. Yeah,
I agree. I mean, look, when I look at this type of political and, you know, social progress, right? You talk about the fact that marijuana is now decriminalized or legal in many states, and there are people making a ton of money, millions of dollars off of this, you know, cannabis industry. And there are thousands, you know, hundreds of thousands of people locked up for low-level marijuana crimes in the country, right? So how can we say as a society that it's okay now, past some point in time and date, hey, guess what? You can have all the weed that you want and make money off of it. But this kid was caught with a nickel bag and is going to spend 6 months in Rikers until his trial comes up, right? And so I think our system is fundamentally broken in the way that, you know, change is slow, right? And what we're seeing in society and technology is outpacing the ability of politicians, and the people that are dictating and making policy are either self-serving oftentimes or don't understand the fundamentals of how the technology is impacting society. And that gap is causing some of these issues.
If Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, who are both running for president, if they came to you and sat with you for kind of 2 hours to better understand Black America and its relationship with technology and the new economy, what can be done from a policy perspective, whether it's Congress or, you know, the a new administration of Kamala Harris or Cory Booker administration? Where would you start in terms of, hey, there needs to be a policy that tackles this inequality? Because if you don't tackle this inequality that's coming out of Silicon Valley, you're going to see more activity like the yellow vest protesters in France or Brexit or Trump, that this causes risk to the society, including economic risk. If you don't have a you can't think about a policy solution to address this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, disinformation is a form of warfare, and we've seen, you know, the cyber policies of, you know, of states acting against the interest of the U.S., right, and intentionally spreading this. I mean, it's factual. Our national intelligence services have validated that, whether people want to believe it or not. When you talk about the relationship of, you know, African-American population, Latino population, as it pertains to tech, I think, you know, there's sort of three components that I think about. One is access. We need to start thinking of internet access more as utility access, like clean water, like we think of it as any other basic human right, right? The digital divide is still very real. People need access to the internet, right? And so there needs to be policy around access. I think the second component of that is around education and ensuring that as the, you know, RPA and AI type solutions come out that are automating low-level tasks, that you don't have a generation of people who were typically in service level jobs that are now completely wiped out and left behind, right? You need to have computer science, engineering backgrounds that are, you know, pervasive throughout the black community in order to reduce that gap moving forward. And then the third one is really around, you know, it's fascinating to me, you know, what came out of the Me Too movement, right? And what came out of the Me Too movement in the flow of dollars on the private equity and venture side is actually fascinating. So you have a lot of large pension funds, family offices, high net worth individuals that are, you know, contributors that said, look, we're against any of these issues. You know, we want to ensure that venture funds have a female partner, have a seat at the table, right? We're no longer going to fund venture firms that don't have female partners. And you've seen a lot of female partners being hired at places, you know, at large funds,
they're being promoted into it. Kind of, some of the top firms were kind of, hey, you know, don't tell us to hire a female partner. You know, that's not really helping anything. And here's our case.
So, you know, where are African-American and Latinos in that, right? Yeah. When I see who's getting those positions, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing at all. Women should have a seat at the table. African-Americans should have a seat at the table. Latinos should have a seat at the table as well. But the same sort of institutional change isn't coming down, right? And so, you know, I think that type of policy, when you look at, you know, how is the flow of capital, which is directly pension funds owned and run, managed by states, right, who can impact this and say, you need to have African-American and Latino partners or we're not going to provide the same level of funding and anchor checks in some of these funds.
What about going a little bit further and saying, look, when we look at auto loans and we look at the mortgage industry, when you look at most industries in the United States, the government itself has found systemic discrimination, right? So the government looking at Google, identifying discrimination against women, the government looking at Oracle, the government looking at Palantir, finding racial discrimination. Do you believe there needs to be a national policy where investors, venture capital and private equity, they have to be transparent about the numbers in terms of the people coming in the doors, the check sizes, and that data needs to be opened up. We're not forcing anybody to do anything, but you can't trust it, meaning that based on the pattern of racism and discrimination, at minimum, you need to open that data up. You need to track that data.
Yeah, I think, you know, overall, I think transparency is the right thing and it's important. I'm always leery of using policy to impact private business, right? In a way, because it sets a precedent for other aspects of managing private businesses that does make sense, right? Where you want to keep things about your cap table or whatever makes sense private, right? So as an investor, I feel two ways about it, right? It's like, hey, I definitely don't want to be forced to open up my books to the world, right? Yeah. And that's why you run a private entity. At the same time, you know, as an African-American in the tech ecosystem, I want to know those numbers for damn sure, right? And I want to make sure that everything's being done to change them. Again, I don't know if I have the right answer, right, and what the solution is, but it's not going to change on its own.
Yeah.
That's for damn sure.
Yeah, particularly, you know, we're seeing that
For particularly public companies, it's a lot easier.
With Facebook, they have to be embarrassed, or they need government, or they need something on them to change. They're not kind of changing on their own. So speaking of Facebook, there was an article in the Washington Post. The writer said Facebook is psychopathic. And for the audience, as a reminder, this is the definition of psychopathy or one. Psychopathy is traditionally a personality disorder characterized by persistent antisocial behavior, impaired empathy and remorse, and bold, disinhibited, and egotistical traits. Okay, so this writer in the Washington Post says this as a culture, Facebook is psychopathic, meaning that, you know, there's a lack of empathy, right? There's antisocial behavior. And so if organizations like Facebook are going to act like governments in terms of they're hiring lobbyists, they're enforcing how communications happen, they're regulating privacy where no one's really kind of looking at them. You know, what type of risk to society would be caused if that's true? Meaning that you have large, influential organizations where psychopathy is in the culture. There's a lack of empathy. It's hard for them to connect to human beings. So if they're building products and we want to move fast and break things and we need to be worth $1 trillion and we don't care and we can't connect with human beings, what type of risk does that pose for society?
Man, lay it all out, the last question. You know, I think it's interesting that you focus on the empathy component. It's the component that I try and I feel like gives me a differentiated ability to connect to entrepreneurs, because I'm not just a VC sitting across the other side of the table, right? And I think what I tried to do when I started businesses was develop a tremendous amount of empathy with every single person I ever brought onto my team, right? And at the core of who we are as human beings, right, is this desire to connect, right? Sit around a campfire and tell stories. And like, that's really what it comes down to, right? I think any organization that lacks empathy will inevitably be a house of cards. You can't sustain without it. It's core to who every single human being is. When you take that and, you know, sort of put it on a grander scale on how lack of empathy impacts products and product design, I think a lot of the studies that we've seen come out around social media in the unhealthy nature with which, you know, either you post or consume, and what you want that to mean in the perceived version of yourself as opposed to your true self. And that becomes detrimental. It becomes unhealthy. And that in and of itself can be a form of disinformation, whether or not you're talking about bots and spreading of fake news, or if you're talking about individuals and how they represent themselves. And so, you know, look, I don't have a Facebook account. I don't have an Instagram account. I had to sign up for one for 2 years when I ran a company because we had Facebook off. So you can't actually develop tools on Facebook without signing up for an account. And so I realized, I think early on, sort of the hooks that they were trying to drive in and be the authentication layer on the internet. And, you know, we're seeing a backlash against that now. And I think we're seeing, initial headwinds of how society feels and the perception of big tech when they feel like they've been misled and led astray and not given 100% of the truth. And that's impacted itself in shareholder value. That's impacted itself in the form of engagement. I think users will... What makes this generation unique of seeing change in technology and digital, right? It took us probably 80 years in the Industrial Revolution to understand the impact of what burning fossil fuels will do on our environment. We're just starting to learn what the impact of social networks and the massive spread of information in a moment's notice can do to a society with changing election results. I think the cycles in which we learn because of digital are getting shorter and shorter, but the impact becomes outsized. And so we're the first generation who's grown up as digital natives, growing up on the internet, and we didn't know what sharing all of your information could do. We didn't understand the ramifications that, you know, sharing all of your information for a free service could come back to bite you in the ass. And people are starting to wise up to it, right? And that's a change. And so I think we're in for another generation of massive change of people who are digital first, online and social, and now fundamentally understand both the good and bad that that brings.
How crazy do you think this idea is? When the entrepreneur is closer to Zuckerberg, the character and moral, psychological makeup, you have a higher probability of success, right? So there's variance in cultures, obviously. What would you say that Black entrepreneurs, Black people, have a disadvantage culturally in the tech space, Silicon Valley ecosystem, because of the cultural makeup in terms of empathy, in terms of the level of humanity, and in terms of the growing up, more people growing up in the church, in terms of you're not built culturally to move fast and break things and build things that could potentially hurt you. You're not built to only look at how big this thing can get, and I don't care. In terms of your connectivity with other human beings, do you think it's crazy that there's a disadvantage culturally in Black America because we may score lower on a Zuckerberg psychopath scoring system?
Look, I can say that 90 to 95% of the black and brown founders that walk through my door ask for less than any other founder who sets foot through my office. They just ask for less money. They might have the same traction. They might have the same aspirations and dreams. They ask for less. And that privilege, that access, you know, psychologically, culturally, where it's do more with less, the hustle, hard, grinded out nature of everything, you know, that plays on the psyche every single meeting that I have. Guaranteed.
That's an important point of asking for less. It's just consistent with studies in the mortgage market where they say that the discrepancy between the black borrower and the white borrower is the black borrower consistently under-negotiates on race. And we can see how in our culture, you're programmed kind of to be at a disadvantage and kind of, you know, you're asking for less.
Privilege is real. Yeah. Like people come in the door and they have no problems asking for $5 million sometimes. I'm like, for what? Barely built anything. Somebody will come through with real traction. Like, I need $350,000 so I can hire a couple engineers, you know? And that's like the rift that I see oftentimes. It's that big.
Are you conflicted from, hey, you need to represent your fund and get the best deal for your fund. But hey, brother and sister, you lowballing yourself based on what the market is.
You're always trying to buy up in value, right? Like at the end of the day, you know, you're trying to own as much equity as you possibly can in a good business, right?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there is very few times in my life where I don't feel conflicted as who I am as an individual and a human being, right? And venture is part of the professional nature of that conflict, which is you want to be as aligned as humanly possible with every single entrepreneur that comes through your door. But you have fiduciary responsibilities to the fund that you manage and trying to return capital back. So the very nature of why I got in, how I work, how I operate, and what I need to do in order to be successful, both from a pure happiness perspective of my life as well as a fund manager, those things oftentimes come at conflict.
Where can our audience check you out online?
Twitter, Kaiso Bond.
Can you spell that out for the audience?
Sure, it's KAGISOBOND.
I want to thank Kai for coming on the show.
Appreciate you for having me. Pleasure.
Let's go. Thanks, everybody, for listening to Go. You can check me out at Jamarl Martin on Twitter, and also come check us out at moguldom.com. That's moguldom.com. Be sure to subscribe to our daily newsletter. You can get the latest information on crypto, tech, economic empowerment, and politics. Let's go.